Welcome to NFL Total Access, the locker room. I'm Michael Robinson alongside Mike Garofolo. What's going on, Jeezy?
You know, hobnobbing with the stars, hanging out, doing the L.A. thing.
Doing the L.A. thing, man. I'm loving it, man. We're on Radio Row, okay? Looking at all the stars passes by and all those things, man. How has Super Bowl week been for you?
It's been great. You know, I came out here and... you know, Jess didn't make it. My wife stayed home.
Oh, man.
She's it's actually gonna be 60 in Jersey on Saturday. But at the time I called her, it was very chilly, and I complained that it was going to be too hot out here,
man,
this week.
A heat advisory.
And she said, "Are you kidding me right now?" And I was like, "Well, no. I packed the wardrobe thinking it was gonna be mid 70s. Then I saw high 80s. I said." I'm not complaining about the heat. All right, I'm going
to
stop.
Yeah,
now.
To shut up.
I keep going deeper on this one. So.
It's all good. So, look, man, let's start this thing off, man. Let's talk about the big hot story in the league right now, man. Roger Goodell had his press conference, his annual press conference during Super Bowl week, and he talked about a lot of Brian Flores' accusations and what's going on with the lack of diversity amongst head coaches, amongst basically the leadership in the National Football League. I thought he did a little tap dancing around some questions. I thought some people at our NFL media group did an excellent job. You talk about MJ Acosta. You talk about Jim Trotter, Steve Weiss. All did a great job asking questions, holding our commissioner accountable, man. Just your thoughts, man, on the whole situation.
Look, I think that Jim acknowledged this in his question.
Yeah.
It's a little misdirected, right? Because the question is not really toward Roger Goodell. It's for the people that he works for. Now, that being said, he's front and center. He certainly is involved in league policy.
Yeah.
But it's not policy that's the problem. The problem is a micro problem that's mm-hmm. tough to address, because the macro problem
is there, yeah.
You look at it, yeah. You say, okay, look at the demographics of our head coaches. Mm-hmm. Put them up, and we've seen it, the headshots, right? Because
yep.
That's the best way to look at it. See the headshots. And you say that's not the same demographics as in our locker rooms.
Nope.
Which this is the Total Access Locker Room podcast, so
keep it
this
real.
Is the perspective of the locker room toward what they're seeing on the head coaching level. So you can do all you want to do with regard to putting people in the position to impress, to get these jobs,
mm-hmm.
which is what the NFL has done through the Rooney Rule. And the Rooney Rule is a good thing in and of itself.
Really?
But it's not enough.
But, Jeezy, to me, the fact that you even have to have it is insulting to me as a black man. I'm not going to lie to you. The fact that I know that the stars of this league, it's been made off the backs of people that look like me, yet you have to put a rule in just to get representation amongst leadership. To me, the fact that you have to mandate that is BS.
Well, let me rephrase. It's a good thing, and it was a good concept and a good intentioned thing that led to Mike Tomlin getting a job. I mean, that was part of it, right?
That's why he got the opportunity to get
interviewed. And so the thought was that this is going to grow over the years, number one.
Mm-hmm.
And number two, you won't need it in the future, right? The thought was you won't need it because this is the step toward creating these opportunities. And then we won't have to insult Mike Robb.
Mm-hmm.
And we won't have to insult folks 20 years down the road because we'll have already gotten to where we think we need to go when this thing was established.
But history tells us that doesn't happen.
We haven't gotten there. And we haven't gotten there. And the reason is, I go back to it, a micro thing. And by that I mean, you could sit there and say, well, we've got to be better as a whole, as a league. But it still mm-hmm. comes down to each
individual team
and each individual owner making the decision. And there's no question in my mind.
How do we get owners to get to know black people and black culture better? Because that's what it comes down to, Jeezy. It comes down to human things, the human interaction, the fact that an owner wants to feel comfortable calling somebody that he feels comfortable talking to.
Yeah.
To me, that's what it comes down to. And I don't think we should be incentivizing teams. I don't think we should be doing anything to force, it's a capitalistic society, to force a company to hire somebody that they wouldn't do it organically. I don't think we should do that. But I do think we should create more opportunity for black ownership, because I think then we wouldn't need the Rooney Rule.
Yeah, and that's going to be the change that you're going to need to start making things happen, because those folks will hire folks that they are comfortable with.
Yes.
That they can. There's no question that over the years, a number of minority and black coaches have walked into interviews and communicated things in a way that was foreign to the people making the decision. And that made them uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And I'm really not trying to say it made them uncomfortable, like, ooh, white guy scared of black guy. I'm just saying it made them uncomfortable.
They just didn't know what they were, they just didn't know, they didn't understand it.
Because they're used to communicating to people in a certain way. And a lot of these owners came up through the business world where people communicate a certain way that is not like any coach communicates.
True.
So I think a lot of cases, you've got owners making decisions on guys who are going to communicate a certain way that they're not used to in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
So now you add maybe somebody who's communicating in a different way on top of that, as a regular human being, on top of communicating like a coach.
Yeah.
And now you got somebody who says, I'm not feeling it. Because it's foreign to them in a lot of ways, okay? And I'm not trying to create a blanket statement. I happen to think that Brian Flores picked the wrong entry point for this one because I don't think the Giants played him funny. There have been sham interviews over the years, and there have been sham processes over the years. The Giants was not a sham process.
Well, okay, well, maybe he said the wrong team, but it does happen,
but
right?
But that's the problem, Mike Robb, because that's when you get to how do you prove – that the white guy over here was hired over the black guy over there because of he was white and because that guy was. You can't prove it. And frankly, the person making the decision might not consciously be saying that. Or in the case of the Giants, ownership, John Mara, Tim McDonald, who is John Mara's nephew, who is in a prominent position with the Giants, I know for a fact, loved Brian Flores. And it came out in the text when he told him, get in here and win this job. They wanted him. And they felt strongly about him at the beginning of the process. But the fact of the matter is they turned it over. And when Dave Gettleman retired, they made it clear that the new general manager, after they fired Joe Judge,
would hire
the coach. So when you hired the guy from Buffalo, who for years now has been saying, hey, when I get a job, that's my head coach right there, the guy I've been working with.
So you think Flores would have had that job?
I think
that was his job to lose pretty much, and he lost it.
He lost it through no fault of his own. And through ownership, and I'm not saying that ownership didn't want Brian Daboll. Mm-hmm. They were definitely impressed with him throughout the process, and they were impressed by how much Joe Shane felt passionately about him. So, again, you can start to go situation by situation by situation by situation. In each situation, you can say, well, here's why it happened.
Yeah.
And it still comes down to, even if you're going to try to incentivize owners, and I know you don't like that, it makes it hard to say, how do we change the thought process behind ownership to make these things happen? That's what's so difficult about this whole thing.
Yeah, and honestly, Jeezy, you can call me cynic. And I was talking to some prominent NFL guys about this that are current players in the league right now. Prominent guys. I can't say their name because they probably don't want to stand behind this. But they don't see it changing. They just don't. Because and one guy said to me, Mike, well, why? Revenue's up. People are watching it. People are addicted to football. It's a drug. Let's be honest. Not in a bad way, but let's just be honest. People are addicted to our game. And from a diversity standpoint, from a representation standpoint of what most of the league looks like, we're going backwards. So if it's not affecting the bottom line, which most of these owners definitely understand that, what would incentivize them to change? I mean, we can have all the public pressure we want. We all know that the communities that I come from, people that look like me come from, we're scratching, clawing, fighting to get to the National Football League because we look at that as our only way out. So it's not like we're going to have a lack of participants. You know what I'm saying? So call me the cynic, man. I don't see it changing ever.
Here's what it'll change.
Ever.
You want to know where it's going to change? And I think it will. And I think it's starting and available to change. It just hasn't happened yet with regard to Byron Leftwich. Eric Bieniemy, too, as well. Yeah. But Byron Leftwich, you were part of a generation where the schemes started to change.
Yes.
And people were more open-minded toward who's going to play quarterback.
Absolutely.
Okay? And so the owners, Jeffrey Lurie is one of them, okay, who is adamant in Philadelphia he's hiring offensive head coaches. No matter what, I'm going to hire an offensive head coach, which I think is ridiculous as an owner to have that.
You can't just say that, man.
Who?
Why would he say that? Why is it all about offense for him?
I know it's been flat out said that, I want to hire an offensive coach because that's the way that he thinks you win in this league is you have a guy who can develop a quarterback and develop an offense. And I understand the thought process.
Yeah.
I'm going to break it down and knock it down in a second. But – just here's my point. So a lot of these guys, if that's the pool that they're pulling from,
Yeah.
They're pulling from offensive coordinators who were, in most cases, former quarterback coaches. Who, in most cases, were former quarterbacks. Who, in most cases, played in the 90s.
So you're saying the process has started already.
I believe so. I believe so. And I believe that the guy I'm sitting across from right now who played quarterback in college would make a terrific coach, executive in the league, Mike Robb, because I know you would. Yeah. Okay? And so now you're getting to the point in the age where these guys that are coming up played the position and are going to be allowed to coach. Allowed. I'm sorry.
I get what you're saying. Yeah.
They're going to be looked to coach the position. And so I think that part of it is coming. But that doesn't excuse a number of things, which number one is Byron Leftwich was available for anybody to hire this year, and he wasn't hired. Eric Bieniemy is an offensive coordinator.
And he was wasn't hired,
And he
man.
Wasn't hired, which –
Pep Hamilton, who is a genius. I mean, I had that guy in San Francisco. Yes. He's a genius.
Those guys are there to be hired, okay? And I can't explain those situations. Mm-hmm. But I will say the majority of the offensive coordinators and the guys that are you know the demographics of that position. Now, here's why it's stupid to, as an owner, say, well, I only want a offensive guy or whatever. Okay, because there are terrific head coaches in this league who have been head coaches for decades.
Yeah.
Who are defensive coaches? Pete Carroll, Mike Tomlin, Bill Belichick. Okay.
And very successful.
And as I've heard defensive coordinators over the last couple of years, as they've interviewed for jobs, explain to owners in interviews, you should be open to the idea of, because they're afraid of, if I hire a defensive coach, I'm going to lose any good coordinator because he's going to go become a head coach. Those guys say, well, you know what? It's not a bad thing to change your offensive identity and your offensive thinking every couple of years anyway. So embrace it and bring in a guy who is going to be a head coach, who is going to run a program, who is going to run the building the way that you
should. A CEO.
I wish if I – oh, my goodness. If I was an owner, if I – look through these couch cushions we got over. If you find $5 billion over there, I'll go buy a team, okay? And I'm going to hire some of the best head coaches and some of the best executives because – teams aren't looking at the defensive coaches. They're not looking at the special teams coaches because I know what a head coach should be, having covered this league. And to just pull the next offensive guy that you can find because he's going to call good plays and develop good schemes, I think it's a huge mistake.
That's a mistake. And one other thing that I'm starting to see, Jeezy, players are paying attention, man. Players in locker rooms now are starting to have a little bit more of a voice. They're starting to, you know, want to have some say in the next head coach. They're starting to say, hey, why isn't it a former player? Why isn't it a guy that looked like me? Why guys are really starting to have this conversation in locker rooms, and it just makes you wonder, do the players have to make a bigger statement to get more representation?
What's the statement?
I don't know, man. I don't know. I heard before the 2005 – not 2005. Yeah, the Super Bowl with the Steelers and Packers. Which one was that, 09 after the 09? I forget which Super Bowl that was.
It was the 2010 season. Yeah, so
yeah,
January or February 2011.
And guys were supposed to get together and do something before and not speak to the media and have a, you know, be solidified as one player's voice. Didn't happen.
No.
You know, so guys are talking about it. That's all I'm saying. And something has to change. I don't know if it will, Jeezy.
I don't think there's going to be any great change. I'll be curious to see what the league is going to do because – for Goodell to say that they're going to address the Rooney Rule, or excuse me, they're going to consider changes. When he says that, it means it's already happened.
Yeah.
Okay, so it's coming down the line. But the question is, I just don't know what more you can do to get to the point where an owner is making the call on who his coach is going to be and do something to change his mind. And you're right. I mean, it should never be to the point where you force him to have to make that decision.
No, you can't do that, man. You force a guy to do something, man. That's when, that's when you get the worst version of him.
All right, so... If you look at these head coaching hirings, on the whole, putting the hot button issues aside and just look at it from a football standpoint, which one do you look at and say, hey, that was a good hire. It's got a good chance of being successful. I like the thought process. I like what he's going to mean for quarterback, defense, whatever. Which one are you looking at saying, that's my guy to be the best, successful?
What's the kid that, and I call him a kid, he's probably older than me, but what is it, Mike?
Mike McDaniel.
Mike McDaniel. I actually like that hire, man. You know, and not because he's a minority hire, but I like the hire because he's a run game guy. He's a run guy, meaning he understands how to manipulate the defense. You hear me talk about it on Good Morning Football Weekend all the time about manipulating the underneath coverage, being explosive in the pass game off play action. To me, he's going to help Tua in a big way. He's going to help Tua understand what he's seeing pre-snap, understand how they manipulate the defense so that post snap he knows exactly what he's looking at. And I think he's going to be able to push the ball downfield. I think they need a run game out there in Miami. They need a run game. They need something to help Tua out, because him dropping back 35 to 40 times, Jeezy, that won't work. I think you don't get the best version of Tua in that type of an offense. That's why I like the hire.
Mike McDaniel, I remember talking about him and talking to somebody who knew him well, who said, you know, all the guy does is all year long, 365 days of the year, think about football, right? Okay. And he's drawing up schemes. And that's why their offense is so dangerous, because he's thinking about in mid-May a way to really take it to a defense and hit some of these home run plays. And that's why they've had a lot of big plays over the years, because of him and Kyle kind of coming together. Here's what I worry about, and this goes back to our previous conversation, which is don't just hire a great offensive mind, because he's not going to have all that time now to just sit there and scheme up things. He's going to have to think about, okay, how do we want to schedule our practices during training camp?
Yep.
How do we want to do this? What about the defensive side of the ball that he's never had to think about? Or ever? So, you know, and I'm not saying that you have no idea until you see a guy in that role. Is he going to melt under the conditions? Mike McDaniel seems like he's a really good communicator. He was very impressive at his press conferences leading up to his hiring, as well as his press conference to announce his hiring. Looks like he's going to be a guy that can communicate to the point. Mike Jones from USA Today asked Mike McDaniel.
Jones.
There you go. Right. So now here's what's funny. It came up with Mike Jones when he asked Lamar Jackson a question a while ago, right?
Uh-huh.
And they played the clip. They're like, hey, Lamar, here's a question from Mike Jones from USA Today. And Lamar starts laughing.
Yeah.
And I'm like, what is Lamar laughing at? I have no idea. Because I don't know.
You didn't know? You didn't catch it?
No idea, okay? No idea.
Oh, my goodness.
But this is what I like. The players are going to know. So when Mike McDaniel makes references to those kinds of things,
yeah.
And they hit home with these guys. Maybe. See, now we're going back to our previous conversation. I can't get away from it. Not that I'm trying to.
It's the biggest elephant in every room we walk in, man.
But hold on. Time out. Maybe if Mike McDaniel is successful and people see this, and it's an example for, hey, sometimes if you get a guy that knows the culture of the players and how to relate to the players, that, you know what? Because – there's different ways. Andy Reid doesn't know any of this stuff either. Andy Reid's a hell of a football coach and has been for years. So this is not to say that that's the only way to get it done. But you know what? If owners can sit there and say, hey, I don't know how he's communicating to me. I don't understand this stuff. But I don't have to understand this stuff. The players have to understand this stuff. Maybe that'll change things. Maybe that'll be the catalyst for change in the NFL. I would say, going back to the Giants, I think Dable is going to be a good hire, and Dable is going to be successful because it's good structure, and they haven't had good structure. They've got a coach.
Daniel Jones, Jeezy, are you kidding me? He's just had Josh Allen for the last 3-4 years, and now he's going to Daniel Jones.
Yes.
Okay? Daniel Jones.
Okay.
You know he's a turnover machine.
Do we know anything? He wasn't that great.
He wasn't turning over the ball that much this year. But have you seen the game where Daniel Jones just said, you know what, get on my back, we're going to win the game based off of me?
One of the things I said coming into this season, when I said, what do we need to see from Daniel Jones? We need to see a get on my back game.
We've never seen it.
We saw it one time. It was that the running, first game.
All that running he did that time?
No, it was in Tampa.
Oh.
Years ago. I think it was the first game he started, or maybe he replaced Eli halfway through. I can't remember
what it was.
He led a comeback. They were down like 20-something points at halftime, whatever it was, and he leads the comeback. And after that game, I went, oh, that's why they drafted him 6th overall. There it is. This guy, what do you mean no?
No. Why come we haven't seen it again?
That's
why come we haven't
saying.
Went back to the moon?
That, so
all of that. It's a sham.
You are going
elsewhere
with that one. You are going elsewhere with that one. But that's what I said coming into the season. That's what I want to see from Daniel Jones, and we didn't see it. But here's the problem. I don't know if that's because Daniel Jones hasn't had an offensive line. Daniel Jones hasn't had a head coach that can take advantage
when
of
you're
what he does.
Picked 6th overall, Jeezy, you gotta overcome some of that stuff, bro.
Now, here's the challenge for Brian Daboll, though, because they got pass happy in Buffalo.
Yes.
The last year or so, or whatever it is. And they kind of got away from their identity that they wanted to establish, which was pound the rock and then throw off of that, because they got a guy that could sling it and they felt good about him. you're now, if you're going to make Daniel Jones successful, you're going to have to go to that identity that you had before. You better not be having him throw it the way that Josh Allen was throwing it and try to set it up that way, because that's going to be a huge mistake.
Maybe they can throw like Chad Pennington.
Maybe they can throw like Chad Pennington.
He's our guest. He's in here. Chad, what's up, big dog?
You don't want to be throwing like me right now. I'm just telling you, boss.
What's going on, Chad? Hey, Jeezy, you know Chad.
Of course I know Chad.
But we sit on the Legends High School and Youth Advisory Committee. We're charged with writing the football curriculum for the next generation of football players. Chad, welcome to the show, man. Before we get started, we start every show with a locker room story.
Well, I'll take you back to my rookie year. New York Jets, Hempstead, New York, on the campus of Hofstra University. Rookie year, Al Groh's our coach, and we are getting ready to do our conditioning test the day before training camp really starts. And, you know, especially back in that time, half our team's over 30 years old. That's the difference in the league now compared to 2000. And so had a lot of great veterans on there. Vinny Testaverde, Wayne Krebet, Curtis Martin, Mo Lewis. And you've got Brian Cox.
Yeah.
On there, okay?
Like where this is going.
Yep, already.
So Kevin Mawai had already made Coach Groh mad because Coach Groh wanted to run with us. It was his first year. He's going to show us he was in with the team. And the vets just weren't having that. They weren't having it. So Coach was a little bit mad anyway. So here we are walking down from the complex, the facility building, to the old bubble that they had created right there for us, about a little 70-yard indoor deal. We're going to run our conditioning test. 300-yard shuttles. That means 50 and back three times.
Oh,
it's a bear. It's a bear, though. You know, that second one, if you're not in shape, that monkey
jumps on
your
back. We had 10 of them
in
college. We had to do 10 of them.
300s or?
10 300s.
Oh, Lord, mercy. Yeah, I wouldn't have made that.
He started sweating with just thinking about it.
That's hard. That's hard because this was hard enough. So I just remember walking down toward the bubble, and Brian Cox and Mo Lewis are in front of me, and I'm this just bright rookie. We had 4 first-round draft picks. We're excited. Anthony Beck, John Abraham, Sean Ellis. We're all excited. And I just remember Brian Cox being about 5-6 steps in front of me. He says, "Ooh, I can't wait to get my hands on some fool tomorrow." And I'm like, man, he plays defense.
I'm a quarterback. That's not good for the home team over here. You know what I'm saying?
So, yeah, I was like, man, my eyes were wide open after that. Of course, that was the, you know, I remember Coach Groh, first day of camp, he pulled us up after practice and said, "Listen, if you're looking for any light at the end of the tunnel, there is none." seven straight weeks of two-a-days. Start grinding. And that was it.
Wow.
There's
just
no light.
It's just amazing what training camp used to be, what training camp is now. When you look at these guys now and how much they've lightened it and made it more mental, and there's a ramp-up period and all that stuff, how many former players you hear say, "Man, I wish it was like that when we were playing"?
Oh, all of us say we'd get 2, 3, 4 more years in.
Of course.
With this schedule,
of
right?
Of course.
I mean, it's
– Of course.
But it just shows you really how you can truly push your body. And to watch us go through that, and that was back with the 3-a-days too. We'd have, you know, 3 or 4 days of 3-days,
yeah.
Three practices a day.
And I played special teams, so it was always 3-a-days for
me. And that was straight banging, right? I mean, it's,
nothing
you know,
else.
So it's definitely a different environment. There's no doubt about it.
You know, the great one who used to be in New England, who finished up in Tampa Bay, Tom Brady. He just finished up, man. You competed against him for years in the AFC East. Just talk about the guy, man, and kind of what he meant to the sport and to the position, because I don't know if we're ever going to see that level of excellence for so long ever again.
Sure. Well, first of all, I think what we witnessed is, and you see this as you're playing, when you're young, your body's right, but mentally and experience-wise, you're not there yet. And so as a pro, it goes in reverse. As your body declines, your mental inclines, essentially, mm-hmm. and you're trying to find that sweet spot to where it's all working together. He found that.
Yeah.
That's why he was playing for that long of a time, because he found it, and he was trying to hold on to it. He was mentally just locked in, physically locked in. He had caught lightning in a bottle, so to speak, where most of us can't. And so that was what was really – special for me to watch him play because it was just a different quarterbacking at a different level. It was just a different level. And so I think also had an inside look. One of my best friends is Byron Leftwich. Okay. And so I got a chance to talk with him every so often. And I asked him, I said, you know, what is it about Tom? And he said, Chad, he said, one, the dude loves football. Yeah. He loves it. And, you know, you can see it as a vet, you can get to a point where you no longer love it anymore, yeah. right? It's Understood. Time to walk away. He loves it. And so that was impressive. And then, two, I thought it was really neat to hear Byron say he never complicates his thought process. Whatever the play calls for, that's how he's going to execute it. And I think that's a challenge for a lot of veterans as they get older and gain experience. They try to make the play more than what it is. And he's able to, where he would really focus on, Byron would say, is, okay, how can I make a better throw on that read? How can I have better ball placement? How can I do the little nuances? But mentally, I'm going to stay sharp and simple with my thought process. And I thought that was really interesting to hear that.
Wow. 0-2 with the Jets, 0-8 with the Dolphins. You were the only one that slayed the dragon in the AFC East during the Tom Brady era. And I know he didn't play in 0-8. He was, I mean, you remember that season where he's down and you go, whoo, finally, we get a break. But they went, what, 11-5?
And
11-5. They still wouldn't go away, right?
Right, yeah.
So I just year after year knowing that to win our division, we're going to have to knock that guy off and that coaching staff up in Foxborough.
Right.
How much did that weigh on you guys mentally every single year?
Well, I mean, you said it, slay the dragon, and the first thing you have to do is you had to slay the dragon in your mind before you even went to play them. I remember in 08 when Tom went down, and we're 0-2 actually. We're struggling. Kurt and the Cardinals just beat the brakes off of us. We can't run the ball at all, and that's where we developed the Wildcat that week with David Lee. And I remember that Wednesday practice just being really, really tense. And we had a team meeting, and I just told him, I said, listen, they lost Tom. Yeah. That's a plus. But number two, we've got to go up there expecting to win. That's half the battle. We're so tight. We can't even practice. We were so tight and so worried about it. And so after that, Thursday and Friday's practice was much smoother, a little bit of confidence. We felt like we kind of had a little bit of a spark and an X factor that they wouldn't know about, which I will say that's the only time I ever played against Vrabel, Brewski, Harrison, those guys, where it was completely silent when they saw the Wildcat. They had no answer.
They didn't know how to answer it, yeah.
They always have an answer,
yeah.
Right? May not be the right one, but they're talking, they're communicating, they're getting no.
So they were
dead,
just like.
Dead silent. It was wild. And so it was kind of neat to be a part of that.
That was a league-changing week and game. Was that stuff in during training camp? Did they do it? Like, when you first heard it, did you think, what are we doing here? Or did you think, oh, this is gonna be great?
It really wasn't in training camp. It was built out of necessity. We were like, how are we going to create just a little bit of space to run the football? And we actually, although everyone tried to mimic it, we had the perfect duo to do it. Ronnie Brown was our Wildcat quarterback. His running style was very patient, stutter in the hole, kind of let it develop. Ricky Williams was our jet sweep man. He was downhill, bowling ball full of butcher knives, right? Mm-hmm. And so it worked perfectly. And you would see other teams trying to mimic it, but they didn't have. And then here Ronnie is left-handed. We're running bootlegs left-handed. He's throwing darts left-handed. So we developed a whole little system. And it wasn't everyone thinks that's all we did. We ran that six times in that game. Now, we scored five times.
Yeah.
But we only ran it six
efficient.
Times. But it was enough to make opponents prepare for it every week.
And Chad, it's crazy, man. And I'm going to go back to something about Byron Leftwich that you were talking about earlier. But it's crazy. In today's game, that Wildcat quarterback now is a real quarterback. And he can throw. He can do everything that quarterbacks can do. And he has that movement ability as well. But let me go back to that Byron Leftwich thing, man. Like, keep it real, man. Like, what's up? What's up with our league right now? This man should have been a head coach a long time ago. I mean, obviously – he knows offense. Obviously, he's able to, you know, structure and put an offense together for the great one in Tom Brady. I mean, he coached him. What can be done to help African-American or black coaches, whatever you want to say, kind of get more opportunities, in your opinion?
Well, I think it starts from the top down. It's kind of similar to this. I coach at a private school. We talk about diversity within our school. And I always say, until our faculty is diverse – until our staffs are diverse, we can't expect the diversity like we want it right? And so that's where it has to, I think it has to start at the top levels too, being able to bring in more diverse ownership, more diverse decision makers, because this is still a relational business. It is still a subjective evaluation on who you want to be your head coach or your general manager. And so the only way that is built is through relationships. And you have to feel comfortable with those people you're working with. I know he's going to be a great head coach. I do. And the reason I know this is because he understands people. If you watch how he coached Tom and coached with Tom, he did a great job of understanding Tom first. It was not about the system. Mm, what does Tom do well? What makes Tom tick? And you could see that Tom had a lot of confidence in Byron. There was
a
lot.
That's the amazing part. Yeah, because that guy's walking in with a lot of skins on the wall, and Byron's still a relatively young coach and young coordinator. It's impressive that you could tell the respect that Brady had for him.
Yes, and I think it's because Tom understood Byron could see it through his eyes. And when you have a coordinator like that, man, it is magic, because he's playing the game through your eyes. And so, I mean, very rarely did you ever see Tom question, or it's like, yep, come on, bring it. Yeah. So whatever you want to run it, coach, we're running it, you know. And so that was really neat. And that's his greatest strength. And, you know, as he gets older in the business and learns how to, you know, do things certain ways, just as far as speaking and all, that'll all come. But he's got the secret sauce, and that is people and understanding people. Byron does, for sure.
When you played, I want to go back to your career, because – you know, we were in the era of big pocket passer, big arm, who can fire it in there. You had the touch pass down to a science. Why were you so effective with that? I mean, I remember covering a game in Philly. You were playing in Philly. I think you won the game. And I'm in the press box, and we had a view kind of over the offense, and I see the ball go up in the air. And the time that it was up in the air, guys are making moves. And like, how did you see into the future like that to be able to put that ball where it needed to be?
Well, I think there's a difference. I always say there's a difference between throwing the football and passing the football. And throwing the football, you see the field in two dimensions. You see windows straight ahead. And passing the football, you see the field in three dimensions. You see pockets. You see holes coming open behind defenders. And that is, to me, that's the secret of becoming a great passer in this league, is the anticipation, because it's not just okay for your receiver to catch it. Let's let him catch it with a little bit of room around him to make something happen. Well, that has to be done. You have to throw that ball early to do that, because the anticipation of the defense, the timing of the defense is so much faster. That everyone talks about the speed of the game at the NFL level. I don't think it's the speed. I think it's the knowledge with the speed. You get the same speed in college. Mm-hmm. They don't have the knowledge these guys have at this level, so that window closes much faster. They anticipate much better, and so now you have to anticipate as a quarterback. That was always a game to me. I wanted to see how early I could get this ball out of my hand and have a coach go, what'd you just do there?
That's right.
You know what I mean?
You know, well, I'm so glad you said that, because here I am in the press box saying, what did he just do there? And you're getting the same reaction from the coaches. That's incredible. What would you say to them?
Well, I remember we were at the Jets 06. We had drafted Kellen Clemens from Oregon, and we're playing Minnesota. And we've got to go in and beat Minnesota to have a chance to go to the playoffs. We were 6-6, and they had a great defensive front. You couldn't run the football. We knew we'd have to throw it more than 40 times. And so we ran just a 18-yard in route to Lavernius Coles. Well, Lavernius and I had played long enough. We'd worked on enough to where sometimes that in route would become a big fat curl, especially against Tampa, too.
Yeah, sit there, yeah.
So I drop back, play action, seven-step drop. The wheel linebacker, we hold him a little bit, and I just throw a lollipop. I mean, it's a lollipop. It had no zip on it. Just a lollipop like this, and as LC comes out of it, it was like a curl route. He wasn't coming in at all. But he knew what was happening. And so Coach Schottenheimer and Brian, he said, Kellen, you see this right here? He said, don't do that. You can't. You're not ready for that yet.
Well, you know what? I remember watching you, man, and you were one of the – because I played a lot of different positions, and you were one of – watching you throw, I truly started to understand the two parts to any throw, right? Yeah, it's the quarterback throwing it. And if that nose is down – it's very difficult to catch sometimes, depending on the receiver and what I'm doing. And you were one of the guys that I saw when that nose is up, you allowed the receiver to catch the ball. And again, like you talk about, do some things after the catch. And that was something I totally always respected about your game. Another quarterback that kind of throws the ball, you know, at times like that. Ben Roethlisberger, what? I mean, he's ending it this year as well. Another guy kind of from your era. What can you say about Big Ben and what he's been
in
this game?
Well, you know, he was a guy that came in and he actually was one of those first guys, big guys, that played the quarterback position more like an athlete rather than just a quarterback, right? And he was okay with taking hits. He was okay with taking sacks because he believed in his ability to extend the play. And that's one of the first few quarterbacks that we first started talking about as far as extending the play.
Yeah, yeah.
Was Big Ben.
And made that a thing. Yeah.
Made it a thing. And now we're looking for that in the evaluation process.
Absolutely.
And so he was able to extend the plays and do those things. And he was a perfect fit for Pittsburgh, especially as a young quarterback where they're playing tough defense, running the football with the bus. He's going to make a couple plays with his legs, a couple play action throws, and there they go, all the Super Bowl. And then as he got older, you could see him become more of a passer, become more of a quarterback, just that evolution, right? And that's something I don't think we have enough patience with, especially at the quarterback position, is the evolution of the player within the position. We're so quick to just try to nail him down with that's who he is, instead of allowing him to grow within the position as he gains more experience.
Daniel Jones, we were having a passionate
don't get me started
debate about Daniel Jones here before you walked up. But I want to talk about another Jets quarterback, because the Jets are still looking for the quarterback to replace Chad Pennington. And it is Zach Wilson right now, who showed me a little bit down the stretch. I don't know how closely you watched it this year, but I saw a little bit of a development for him down the stretch. What do you take out of his first year, and what do you expect going forward?
Well, I take that he was 21, turning 22. That blows my mind. Right. He's going to play like a 21-year-old, like he should. And so when we try to place a billion-dollar organization on the back of a 21-year-old, Joe Burrow is what, 25?
Yeah.
Well, that makes a difference, right?
Okay.
Yeah. So that's one. So patience. Now, I do think it used to be more of a 3 to 5 year process. I don't think we have that much patience anymore, but I still think we can gather, okay, can this dude really do it within 3 years? We can figure that out. For Zach, I think an interesting point, I was actually able to talk with Mike LaFleur's dad at the Pro Bowl, and we were just kind of talking just ball, and he's an old ball coach. And if you remember, Zach, when he was there at the beginning of the year, the oldest guy in his room was a third-year guy.
Mm-hmm.
There was no veteran in that room at all.
That.
That is ludicrous to me, number one.
Mm-hmm.
I remember walking in. I've got Vinny Testaverde. I've got Ray Lucas just in my room.
Oh, my goodness.
Never mind Curtis Martin and Wayne Corbett and all the other dudes outside of the quarterback room. I was able just to watch and learn. Well, he didn't have that. But there was a change in the development you're seeing. Joe Flacco came in. And so Zach was able to watch Joe a little bit and see how to be a pro, see how to prepare, see, just, you need all those different experiences so you can kind of gather who you're going to be as a pro. Not looking at a second year guy.
That's
he's still
true.
Trying to figure that it out too.
Yeah, he don't know
he
what's
have
going
any
on.
Answers. No.
Real
quick, the Jets got killed for that trade. What did you get out of Joe Flacco? I think they gave up a 6th round pick or something like that. Yeah, they should have signed him or whoever in the spring. I know some guys didn't want to go there, by the way, was another thing. But regardless, they should have signed a veteran. So they had to give up the pick. But frankly, you're looking at it the wrong way. And you, Chad, you just described it perfectly. You're looking at it the wrong way if you say, what did they get out of Flacco? If they got development out of Zach Wilson,
then you got all you needed.
Hell of a worth a 6th round pick.
You got all you needed out of them. Now I'm going to go down to South Beach, Tua. Got a new coach, Mike McDaniels, right? Am I saying it right?
McDaniel,
no S. Out looking for 2022 for Tua, man. What do you expect? What's the next step for him? I do think he gets unfairly criticized sometimes.
Sure.
But, yeah, just what's your outlook on Tua for 2022?
Well, his number one goal is to stay healthy.
Yeah.
That's number one. You don't push the reset button, but I don't think you can just – believe that he's just going to ascend right to the top. There's too much change, right? And so, but he can have some positive change and still improve. It does seem like Coach McDaniel has a bright mind, you know, really understands offensive football, so that should be exciting for Tua.
Yeah.
But it's going to be all about stability. That's what it is around the quarterback. It is about stability in everything you do as an organization. From the offense you run to the routine to how you teach fundamentals and skills, all of those different things, it has to be about stability. We're wanting our players to be stable when our organizations are not. Well, that doesn't go together, Right. That's so that's the biggest thing, in my opinion.
Before we get you out of here, we want to get your thoughts on these quarterbacks in this game here on Sunday. Let's go from youngest to oldest and start with Joe Burrow. We're hearing the comparisons to a young Tom Brady, which is a hell of a burden to put on a young guy.
I see it.
You do see it.
I do see it, man. I mean, just like, and Chad, you know this, and I don't mean to dominate your question, Mike, but how many times do we, and you said it earlier in the podcast, how many times do we see young quarterbacks try to get more out of a play than what the play is designed to do it? I don't see Joe Burrow do that unless it's needed at the end of a game, it's fourth down, and he has to make a play. But Joe Burrow, if the defense calls him to throw this five-yard play every single time, he throws it every time.
That's a great point, and here I can back up your point by this. Oh, my gosh, he took 9 sacks in the Tennessee game, or he had, there was 9 sacks. So what? That may have been the best play at that time. Yes. Like, none of those sacks changed the game. Nope. Didn't change field position, wasn't a turnover. So that lets you know that he's trying to do what's best at that time. And the sack didn't affect him mentally.
Nope.
Right? He just kept coming back, That's what I'm most impressed with is his resiliency. Mm-hmm. That's very hard for a young quarterback. I mean, to go into Arrowhead down 21-3, I mean, come on. Are you serious?
Man, that's awesome.
You know,
man.
It is awesome. Yeah. And he did some of that with his legs, too, and he's not known as a burner.
No.
But that just shows you don't have to run a 4-5 to make plays with your feet. You make plays as a quarterback when it's called to make a play with your feet. If you're looking to make plays with your feet as a quarterback, you're going to be in the ambulance.
That's true.
You're going to be in the ambulance.
Points. You hit his Jeezy. You're making them points right there.
And your career is going to be short. Yeah. That's not what you're paid to do. So I'm really impressed with his resiliency and just his level of – I was also impressed with after the game. I expected actually more excitement from him and his team. And it's like, no, this is – we expected this. This is what we're doing.
That's true. I didn't even think about it that way.
If you watch the interviews on the field.
He's cool.
Cool. They're not jumping up and down, going crazy, nothing. Yeah.
Well, the job isn't over. He understands that.
Right. And so that's a level of maturity I think that's unique.
And they started that mantra after winning the division. That was their thing, was like, this is nice, but we expect more than
supposed
this.
Supposed to be here.
Right. Yeah, so it's good. So it's good to establish that early. And then Matthew Stafford, certainly worth what they gave up for him at this point. I know there were some rocky points this season, but really impressive in the postseason. Your thoughts on Stafford?
Well, let's go back to the Tampa Bay game. To do what he did in those 40 seconds was so hard. People have no idea. Atlanta Falcons couldn't do it, right? And so it's 27-3. You've got all the momentum. You're in Tampa, the greatest quarterback to ever play. They're winning that game. Mm-hmm. And if he doesn't do that with that drive and it goes into overtime, they don't win.
They do not win.
And so for him to be able to say, okay, 27-27, we've got 40 seconds, and to make a couple of those throws that he made, and even, like, the call by Todd Bowles to be cover zero, that's the right call defensively. It really is. Mm-hmm. He stepped up, put his foot in the ground, let that sucker fly, you know, and there it is. And so, little things like that I catch on to that we don't sometimes give enough credit for and actually truly, admire the competitive nature and desire in that moment and how hard that is. I mean, that is – human nature would just tell you, I'd get patted on the back. You played hard. You had a great year. He didn't. He made a choice to go, no, we're going to go win this game, even with all this that's against us. And their home, on their home field against the greatest of all time, I thought that was absolutely remarkable.
Who gets the win? Who gets the win? Have you got a prediction yet?
Well, I think that if the Rams let those boys hang around into the fourth quarter,
it's going to be bad for them. I'm telling you, man.
It gets a little nerve wracking, right? So I think the Rams really need to focus on getting off to a great start, really putting the pressure on them. Because if it's close and they're able to make some plays moving in that fourth quarter and gain a little momentum, it can change real fast. It's a Super Bowl crowd. It's not a Rams crowd. It's
That's a corporate crowd.
It's,
that's true.
You know, all these different things that the Super Bowl provides.
Yeah, they're going to root for the underdog. That's how it happens. It's like at March Madness when the teams that are waiting for their game to start, they want the underdog. So all of a sudden the crowd turns in favor of those guys. So that could happen there. I will say this. Having talked to Cincinnati folks before that Kansas City game, their thought was, let's just make it a game in the fourth quarter because who's the expectations going to be on? It's not going to be on us.
It's going to be on them.
And I guarantee you that that'll be the way that they approach this game as well.
Absolutely. All right, Chad. You good, Jeezy? You good?
I'm not good. Here's why I'm not good. So I covered the Giants from 2004 to 2012.
He goes
so I was
right
in the same
something.
Market as Chad, and I didn't get to cover the Jets. And I'm telling you, having this conversation, I mean, I watched him from afar, and I knew him from afar. I wish I would have covered him. I would have been his locker every day, which at some point he would have said, get out of here, guy. But, you know.
That's some good conversations, man.
Yeah. Let me tell you, Jeezy is one of the all-time greats, man. I mean, he really watches the tape. I mean, he calls me during the week. Hey, Mike Bob, turn the play such and such on this second quarter. What the hell is he looking at right here? I mean, he actually watches the tape. That's so, Chad, thank you for stopping by. That'll do it for this week's episode of Total Access, The Locker Room. For more insight with The Locker Room Point of View, check out the latest episodes on Apple and Spotify.